You're listening to a special podcast from the annual convention of the Federation of Atheist, Humanist, and Secular Student Societies. In this series of podcasts, you'll hear from the speakers at the conference, recorded on the 2nd of March, 2013. This podcast is of Andrew Copson, Chief Executive of the British Humanist Association. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine program about interesting things, from science to culture to politics, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. Now here's AHS President Jess Vautier introducing the speaker.
Welcome to the third annual AHS National Convention. I'm Jess Vautier, I'm AHS President. We've got a little stall at the back there with Matt, the Treasurer, and Emiko is somewhere around with a clipboard. So today is our speaker day. We've got an awesome lineup for you. So you should all have schedules on your seat. If you don't, you probably can share with somebody next to you. We have a raffle, which is over at the BHA stall, just over there, for the There's Probably No God banner, which is signed by Richard Dawkins. So raffle tickets are, I think, £1 or £3 for a strip. Yeah. And if you would like to tweet about today, we've got an official hashtag, which is hashtag AHSCon. So you should be able to pick up on what everybody else is saying. So, without further ado, I will introduce our first speaker, who is the president of, no, not president, the chief executive of the British Humanist Association, Andrew Copson.
That was a very short introduction. I was expecting at least another 10 minutes to be able to sit there and think about what I was going to say. Okay. Is my presentation already on here? Does anyone know? Can anyone help me? Isn't it early? Early in the morning.
Trinity?
Yeah. Have you come far? Have you a long way? Exeter. I knew that just by looking at you. North London. Okay, South London. That's not really very different. Okay, great. Thanks very much. So it's good to be here. It's good to be here at the third year of the AHS convention. I spoke at the first one and the second one. This year I'm speaking about the BHA. Generally and specifically our work and a little bit about humanism. You're very lucky because that's the most interesting talk that I've given in the 3 years that I've been here. The first year was about the census campaign. Last year, very dull, was erotic pictures of sexy priests and nuns. You're all wishing you were here last year, aren't you? Instead of this year. Okay, since it's you, I'll just a reminder of what you missed. They're all available online. Just Google sexy priests and nuns. Here's the nun, since I promised a nun. But before... we'll just leave that up there for a moment. Before... it's topical. It's not just gratuitous. It's topical. I want to talk to you today about humanism and the BHA. I don't want it to seem as if it's all about me talking about myself and the organisation. So I'm going to start by talking about you. By which I mean those of you here who are still students and of an undergraduate age and running the sort of societies that we're trying to promote. Because in many ways, you're the most secular demographic, if not in the world, certainly then in Europe. 96% of people who are of undergraduate age don't go to church on an average week. More than 70% of 18 to 24-year-olds say that they are not religious. These figures come from mainly from hostile sources, from sources that are trying to point out that this is a really awful and bad thing, which hence the the headline, I don't think it's appalling, obviously. What I'm conveying to you is the attitudes of the people from whom these figures come. And even in the 2001 census, where we know that the number of non-religious people was massively underrepresented because of various factors, 55% of people of undergraduate age tick no religion. Now, very, very probably, that is significantly higher in the 2011 census, but we don't have the age breakdowns, the age-related breakdowns. Of that yet, so we can't be sure. Now, these facts have got some people extremely terrified. The Archbishop of York, John Sintami, who thankfully didn't become the Archbishop of Canterbury very recently, responded to the report that contained these figures and other figures by saying they were shocking, a wake-up call, and the church should panic. And what were they most concerned about? What was the most disgusting and shocking thing about it? The biggest threat was that the data indicated that these young people found meaning and significance in the reality of everyday life. It's fascism, I tell you, fascism. Okay, so that's the biggest threat. So take comfort from the fact that you are threatening people like the Archbishop of York, not literally, but in this metaphorical way. I want to talk today about the British Humanist Association because I don't know that necessarily all of you will be completely familiar with the full range of work that we do. Here are our vital statistics. The British Humanist Association, founded in 1896 as the Union of Ethical Societies, that was the original name, now has some 30,000 members and supporters. That makes us one of the largest humanist or secularist group in Europe that's not state-funded. Some humanist groups in Europe, like in Norway or the Netherlands, Belgium and parts of Germany, get state money to promote their activities. We don't. Obviously, we're completely funded by members and supporters and raffle tickets. Quite different. We've got a London office with 13 paid staff and 30 regular volunteers, either in the office or working remotely. And we're very lucky when we're developing our policies and other work to have those policies informed by 120 scientists, philosophers and other thinkers, some of the leading minds of Britain and leading minds in their fields, people who are vice presidents like Simon Blackburn and Richard Dawkins, Polly Toynbee and our president Jim Al-Khalili, who'll be talking to you later today. We have over 60 local student and special interest affiliates, over 130 local development volunteers engaging in local public affairs, and about 500,000 people attend one of our non-religious funerals or other ceremonies conducted by the celebrants that we train each year. So that's about us. There are different areas of our work. I now want to move from this microphone to that microphone. Can I just do so? If I use them both at once, does that sound weird? No, it doesn't. I was hoping for some good effect. Yeah? I'll just put this down. Okay. It's early in the morning, and I feel the need to grip the lectern, that's all. I can't be moving around all the time. Slightly hungover. Okay. One of our areas of work, promotion and education. This is incredibly important. So part of our mission is to explain to the world what humanism is, to help people to give a name to the beliefs and values that they may have themselves. We do this by sending speakers into schools. We have a speaker training program that trains people in what is currently taught in school and different aspects of the curriculum where humanism and related issues can be explored, in how to go into schools, how to give a good account of yourself, how to meet teachers' aspirations and be useful to young people. And those speakers go in and talk about atheism as an answer to the question whether there's a God or not, where that question, for example, appears in RE. They talk about humanism. They may talk about humanism in the context of RE, or they may talk about it to sixth form groups who are doing some sort of enrichment general studies work, or they may talk about it in history or in English. I once talked about humanism in the novels of E.M. Forster to a sixth form group at a Catholic school, with three nuns at the back to make sure I didn't mention any of the unsavoury aspects of E.M. Forster's life. So I didn't. I just pointed out he was a great humanitarian and that, like many people of goodwill, he wanted to reach out across the divisions of religion and belief, and that's why he spent 10 years with a passionate affair with an Egyptian bus driver who was a Muslim while he was a humanist. And that seemed to go down very well. That's not part of the general training program, but that's part of creative thinking on your feet. Produce resources for learning about humanism, to support schools in learning about humanism, videos and worksheets online, lesson plans, and other sorts of resources. We do training for initial teacher training institutions across the country, a big program of training that happens every year in about 10 or 11 institutions. And we produce courses for running by community groups, things like University of the Third Age or local humanist groups who open these courses up to people in the local community, accepting and acknowledging that, you know, education settings in formal educational settings is very important, and education in those settings is very important, but we also have a wider idea of what education means, and we want every man and woman in the country to be able to think about these issues and to be able to understand humanism if that's a view that is appropriate for them. The second broad area of our work, going beyond education, and of course there's a lot more to that than I could set out in the time available, but that will do for a summary. Community services. Now, this part of the BHA's work has changed over time. So there was a time when, for example, the BHA supported and promoted Humanist Housing Association, which provided residential housing for older people, an agnostic adoption agency in the 50s and 60s. And the reason to get into that sort of community services provision was because there wasn't really the sort of provision for non-religious people that existed for religious people. So many housing associations were provided, you know, outside state structures by religious groups. Some non-religious people found it very difficult to get access to adoption services given their beliefs, and found there was a barrier because of that. And so humanist alternatives, equivalents, were set up for those sorts of services. Now, in the case of adoption and housing, obviously, when the barriers against non-religious people to access the secular services had diminished and those services were open to everyone, there was no longer a need for separate provision. So the BHA's community services work changes in response to the external context all the time. At the moment, it's predominantly focused around the provision of ceremonies. So we have over 300 trained and accredited celebrants who, for example, provide funerals that have dignity and meaningfulness in them that you just can't get by just having a vicar in the crematorium when you don't really believe the things that he's saying. Our celebrants work with families to try and create funerals that are personalised, that are meaningful and have significance and relevance for the people that attend them, and also the life of the person who's died. And that's a remarkably important service that we provide in an increasingly secular age. They do other ceremonies as well. They do weddings, they do baby namings, they do divorces. Not very many. You know, people aren't always in the mood to have a ceremony, certainly not a dignified ceremony, at these times. But we do them. We'll do any ceremony, really. Within reason. They're growing in popularity every year. You may know that in Scotland, humanist marriages, which are legally recognised, which they're not in England and Wales, last year humanist marriages overtook Roman Catholic marriages in their number, so there are almost 3,000 humanist marriages a year now in Scotland. Not so many here, because we don't have a legal status for those marriages, but as I said, about 500,000 people attend one of our funerals every year, so it's a large number. And then more recently, we've been developing additional aspects of the community services work that we do by running pilot projects of pastoral support in prisons and hospitals for non-religious people. So I don't know if any of you have ever been in prison. Anyone want to? Okay, you don't have to declare it. This isn't that sort of occasion. But if you go into prison as a... not a patient, what are you going... an inmate, a prisoner. I'm getting the two confused. Hospitals, prisons, they seem... If you go into prison as a prisoner, they take your religion. It's one of the bits of information that they collect from you statutorily. And they ask quite a silly question to get it, a bit like the census question. And then that information gets passed over to the prison chaplain, who by law is a statutory office holder in every prison. And it's run by... centrally, this prison service by an Anglican priest. I don't know what the name of the current one is, but the name of the old one used to be the Venerable William Noblet, which is a terrible thing to use people's names as humorous devices, but that wasn't what I was doing. I was just pointing out a simple fact, and you attributed whatever meaning to it you want. But the venerable William Noblet, who rejoiced in his role as much as in his name, used to administer this system of prison chaplains, and there is presumably some equivalent with a less interesting name currently doing so now. And when they've got this information about your religion, and the chaplain has got it, they go through the list and they say, OK, we've got Christians. The Anglican chaplain, the statutory Anglican chaplain, will deal with the Christians, unless they're Roman Catholics, we might get a priest in. We've got Jews, we've got Muslims, we've got Buddhists, probably not very many, we've got Sikhs. And we will call in a rabbi for the Jews, we'll get hold of an imam for the Muslims, and we'll find, you know, a religion-specific person to cater for the needs of all these people. And then we've got, you know, 25 to 30% of non-religious people, and they can have the Anglican chaplain. So although every non-Christian religious prisoner gets some sort of specific provision, the chance to interact with someone who shares their view of the world, the chance for time out of your cell to do so, and to attend maybe discussion groups and so on, non-religious people get landed with the Church of England chaplain, which is not necessarily the most pleasant of experiences. So we provide volunteers, trained volunteers, who are there to provide pastoral support, run discussion groups and so on for non-religious prisoners. And we've done pilots of that in HMP Winchester, which have gone extremely well in spite of the obstruction of religious chaplains within the prison, which has been really quite aggressive. It's gone quite well. And we have equivalent pilot projects running in hospitals. Now, hospitals aren't so much of a problem for non-religious people who are in there as patients, because they are more open settings. But nonetheless, they're still dominated, the pastoral support provision within hospitals is still dominated by either hospital chaplains paid by the hospitals or the sort of volunteers who come in for religious befriending and so on. So they're two pilot projects and ways which might extend our community services. And then probably the biggest area of our work, at least in terms of public attention and public impact, is our public affairs work, so our work campaigning. We campaign for secularism in law and government, on things like disestablishment of the Church of England, on things like bishops in the House of Lords, on things like ending the contracting out of public services to religious bodies. And in addition to our campaigning on secularist issues, we campaign on various public ethical issues from a humanist perspective. So, for example, things like sexual and reproductive health rights for women, things like assisted dying for the terminally ill, things like stem cell research, and so on. In doing that, we work with the All-Party Parliamentary Humanist Group, which is just over, I think, over 115 now MPs and members of the House of Lords who are humanists, or in one case, a very supportive Christian. We let him join because, you know, he was very friendly. And with... In fact, I'm going to name check him. His name is Peter Bottomley. He's a Conservative... His name is Sir Peter Bottomley, actually. And he's a Conservative MP who also delivered an extremely passionate and compassionate speech in favour of same-sex marriage in the recent debate in the House of Commons on same-sex marriage, and showed himself to be a man of true principle. And remain silent on his political affiliation on the assumption that this is mixed company and the BHA is a non-political organisation. So the All-Party Parliamentary Humanist Group we work with, and we also work with Lawyers for Humanism who do things like help us with our judicial reviews or interventions in legal cases. And our current campaigns, I've alluded to some of them, include things like state-funded faith schools, worship in schools, the school curriculum, bishops and the Lords, contracting out of public services to religious groups, free speech issues, and there are 21 campaigning areas in total that we're working on at any one time. So it's a really huge agenda, public policy agenda that we have. It's in many ways beyond the reach of a small voluntarily funded organisation like the one that we have, but we're very fortunate to have extremely hard-working staff, extremely dedicated volunteers, and of course rightness and truth and justice on our side. And that means that we can be very, very confident of success any decade now. I just want to focus on two of the areas that are particularly prominent at the moment. So education in schools, what are the different ways in which we take action to achieve our aims in education in schools? So one of them is through legal action. For example, 2 or 3 years ago, we intervened in a court case involving the JFS, the Jews Free School in North London, who were discriminating on the basis, in admissions, on the basis of Jewishness. And because Jewishness, as a religion, emphasises maternal descent, their discrimination on the grounds of religion, which was legal, because discrimination on the grounds of religion in schools is legal, was also discrimination on grounds of race, on grounds of ethnicity, because it was about descent. It was about, you know, is your mother ethnically Jewish? If she is, you're a Jew, and you can come to our school. If she isn't, you're not, and you can't. Sorry. Even though we're 100% state-funded. So this legal case was saying, actually, although the Jews Free School is saying that this discrimination is religious and therefore legal, in practical terms, it's ethnic, it's racial discrimination, and therefore illegal. And we intervened to support that case, and the legal arguments that our barristers used were actually quoted back in the final judgments when that case was won. So that case was being brought by a parent, and we were one of the interveners who came, sort of filed, as it were, in a, what's called an American amicus brief, to be a friend of that party and to say, this is our argument. And we were lucky enough to enjoy success on that occasion. Other ways that we've taken legal action, for example, recently we managed to defeat the government at the Information Tribunal and force them to release the names and religions of free school applications, which they'd been resisting releasing. And most recently we took Richmond Council to court to try and prevent the opening of a new Catholic voluntary-aided school in that area, on which occasion, unfortunately, we were unsuccessful. But got good media coverage out of it, and that's a sort of secondary benefit to taking legal action, is that you can also raise awareness of the general issue that you're promoting. As well as legal action, we support local campaigns. So we've done a lot in the last few years, as decision-making has become a lot more localised, to support individual parental campaigns to stop new faith schools in their area. One of the biggest myths about faith schools is that they are popular with parents. Right. This was always what the Labour government said to justify their policy of increasing the number of state-funded faith schools. It's also what the current government says to justify their policy. They say, you know, okay, even if we don't like them ourselves, and we do really anyway, but even if we don't like them ourselves, says the government, who are you to stand in the way of parental choice? And parental choice, when exercised, clearly favours clearly favours religious schools. Well, that's rubbish. Actually, what parents want for their children is an academically successful school with a good ethos and, you know, good behaviour. Many state-funded religious schools are academically successful, but they're only academically successful because the law allows them to select their intake. And again and again and again, research has demonstrated that religious selection has an impact on socioeconomic selection. Not necessarily deliberately, but, for example, you know, who are the people who have the time to go to church services every week to get themselves actively involved in the community of their local church? It's not necessarily going to be a single mother working 3 jobs. And the same factor relates to other sorts of religions that require different sorts of tests of piety in order to access their schools. So one way or another, religious selection leads to socioeconomic selection, and that's one of the reasons why schools are academically successful. But the other reason why the argument from parental choice is foolish is that education is just not a market in the way that, you know, other things that you consume are. If you're living in an area where there is only one school, for example, and it's a primary school and it's a Church of England school, parental choice doesn't enter into it. And even when you ask parents who send their children to faith schools what their motivation was for sending them there, religion comes typically 9th or 10th on the list, and sometimes it doesn't feature at all, and only a very small percentage of parents say that it was the main reason. So, in fact, parental campaigns to stop new faith schools are very widespread and just need our support. And then, of course, there's the classic way of trying to achieve your political end by lobbying on bills in Parliament to try and change legislation. And so, for example, the Children's Schools and Families Bill that's going through at the moment, we'll probably be doing a few amendments with our friends in Parliament on that to try and move things towards where we want to go. And these days, there's also action at the European level. So, by being part of the European Union, the UK is committed to certain equality provisions, certain non-discrimination provisions, various ways in which domestic UK law actually violates those principles. For example, we think in the way that faith schools' employment is organised. So, state-funded, totally 100% state-funded faith schools can discriminate in varying degrees across almost the whole staff pool. They don't have to take the best candidate as their school leader, as their head teacher. They can take the best Catholic candidate or the best Anglican candidate or whatever. Now, as well as being very bad actually for those schools, because re-advertising rates for those jobs are three times as high as they are in community non-religious schools, because there just aren't enough well-qualified religious people out there. That's not meant to sound offensive. Just because there aren't many religious people, not because they're not well-qualified. It ends up disadvantaging the school. It also is a plain discrimination against teachers and non-teaching staff who are not of that religion but have a right to a job. And so we've currently got a case with the European Commission over faith schools employment in the UK that's being investigated by them to see if the UK government is, as we say it is, in breach of its obligations there. So that's just a quick insight into education and schools campaigning. As I say, that's just one of our 21 different policy areas, so you can see there's a lot going on at any one time. I thought I'd just briefly mention some of the ethical issues that we work on. How many people remember the Tony Nicholson case? It was very, very recent. He was a man with locked-in syndrome, and he went to court for the right to die. Even the national organisation that works on issues of right to die at the end of life, dignity in dying, didn't actually support him because they only support terminally ill people who want medical assistance to end their life, not people who are unbearably suffering, as Tony Nicholson was. But we did support it, and we're now intervening in the court case that is continuing, because although Tony Nicholson has died, his widow Jane has been given permission by the court to proceed in her own name with this case, and we made a massive submission, ethical and legal submissions about this just last week, ready for when the case is heard later this year. And the value that we could add to that case was obviously, I mean, not just saying yes, well, we think that people who are in his position should be able to end their lives, but we were also able to make legal submissions because of the pro bono barristers who were working for us, for free to help us, and also give substantial ethical weight to those submissions by using some of those 120 people that I mentioned earlier. So Simon Blackburn, John Harris, AC Grayling, various other people at the top of their game in terms of ethical thinking about these sort of issues were able to prepare the submissions that we lodged with the court, make the sort of arguments that the court should be taking into account when they discuss this sort of case. Again, parliamentary work, for example, on laws governing organ donation. We've been active in making submissions and lobbying for change. And we join in coalitions nationally and internationally on other ethical causes like Anti-Slavery International, women's reproductive and sexual health rights, to give substance and form to our ethical principles. This is just a few of the campaigns that we've run in the last few years, just to remind you of how brilliant we are. The Atheist Bus campaign, which of course was a runaway success in 2009, raising over $150,000 to put the advert on buses across the country, emulated internationally over 20 countries. There's Probably No God, our famous slogan, humorous, as in, there's probably the best lager, that sort of advertising joke. It made everyone laugh. Not right now, obviously, but back then. The old ones aren't always the best. And it would have been There's No God, but the Advertising Standards Authority wasn't so happy with that sort of claim. The Protest the Pope. Let's take a moment just to... Not Schadenfreude, exactly. Though it's a fine German word. But just a moment to consider those we have lost in the past, yeah. we were part of the coalition that protested the state visit of the Pope and organised the largest march and rally against the policies of the Holy See in modern times. So that was all good fun. We were amazed by the number who turned out in the end. I mean, it really was huge. Not that you'd have known it if you'd been watching the BBC, rather than actually being there. The census campaign, back in 2011, we were urging people who are not religious to say so in the 2011 census, because the data showing inflated figures for the religious had been used since 2001 to justify a lot of damaging policies. So just to simply rehearse, I mean, you probably know all this. But the question on religion was introduced for the first time in the 2001 census. And it was phrased in a very problematic way. The question was, what is your religion? Which is not exactly an open question in many ways. And so people were almost forced into a religious response, even though they didn't believe in God, didn't have a religious identity, and never practiced any religion. A lot of people ticked Christian, but also a lot of secular Sikhs and Jews ticked Sikh or Jew because they didn't have the chance elsewhere on the form to give an ethnic and a religious answer separately. So there's a huge over-reporting of religious identities, huge under-reporting of non-religious identities, and those figures were then used to justify various sort of theocratic government policies like expanding faith schools, like keeping bishops in the Lords, anything. They would justify anything with these figures over the 10 years. So we were campaigning with posters and flyers and everything everywhere for people who, if they weren't really religious, to tick no religion. And I'm not saying it's solely because of our campaign, but the fact that there was an increase by 40 million, that's an exaggeration, by 100 million exponential increase there was in the non-religious, 14 million people, was obviously entirely because of our campaign. Wholly redundant, the Remove Bishops from Parliament campaign. That was our campaign to have bishops removed from Parliament as part of the government's Lords reform. And although the government's Lords reform plans were dropped, our campaign did result in bishops being the most lobbied on issue at the time of the government's bill. So the issue to do with Lords reform, on which MPs and Nick Clegg, responsible for constitutional reform, and the government generally got most lobbied on in those 3 months, was bishops, which is remarkable. And then more recently, we've had the campaign on national remembrance ceremonies for all who serve, working for representation of the non-religious armed forces personnel at the national commemoration ceremonies for those who've died in war. The number of non-religious serving armed forces personnel outnumbers by about 10 times all the non-Christian religious number of armed forces serving personnel. But although there's a Baha'i and a Sikh and a Jew and a Zoroastrian even now, I don't think there are any Zoroastrians in the armed forces at all, at the National Remembrance Ceremony, there's no representative of, for example, the UK Armed Forces Humanist Association. Now, how long have I got left? Because I thought I was meant to speak for 10 minutes. That's clearly not the case, or if it is, you know, I've been allowed to go on for an awful long time. What time is it now? 15:15? What time am I meant to finish? Really? Well, I don't have to go straight to questions. I've got more to say. Don't worry. We could go straight to questions. I'd do a little bit now from another talk that I've given maybe to some student groups, actually, called Objections to Humanism, because I think one of the things that we can do for you at a day like this, I mean, tomorrow all the students who are here will be having workshop sessions about how to do various things on campus. I've told you something about the BHA, but I think I also want to tell you something about how you can counter some of the objections that you typically get to your view, because the work that you're doing to promote humanism, atheism, secularism on your campuses is obviously done through events, but it's also done through conversations, through being able yourselves to represent these views confidently. And so I'm going to run through at least one of the objections to humanism that is quite prevalent. And it's this one, the objection that humanists can have no morals. Or, I just can't understand why you're not a rapist. This was actually, I'm going to go back to this microphone now. Can I go back to this one now? I'm feeling a bit livelier. Feeling a bit more like it. Can you hear me? Humanists can have no morals, or I just can't understand why you're not a rapist. So this was actually said to me by someone, by a Catholic priest, on a on a train journey back from a conference where we'd both been speaking. We'd been speaking about various bits and pieces, and we were sharing a packet of crisps. He very ostentatiously shared his crisps with me. It's the small moral victories that are the tastiest. And maybe he blessed them, actually. Maybe I was eating holy Doritos and I didn't even... It was his... Probably not. And we've been talking about morality, and I've been talking about, you know, humans' view of morality, and he'd been talking about his view of morality, and he said, well, if you believe all that, I just can't understand why you're not a rapist. Well, I think we generally understand that the point that's being made is the point that would have been made to many of us, if not in formal debates, then, you know, in the pub or whenever. So the claim is, the objection to humanism is, that without some sort of external, unchanging, transcendent, divine origin for our morality, essentially any moral principles that we happen to choose to adopt are arbitrary, have no basis, have no foundation, are unsustainable, and are probably going to lead us into the Third Reich. That's generally the view. Not always that extremely expressed, but sometimes that extremely expressed. It's not necessarily the view that non-religious people can't behave morally, because some religious people, like, for example, the former Bishop of Rochester, will say things like, of course non-religious people can behave morally, but they really only seem to be behaving morally. They're actually sort of just spending the moral capital that was banked by their Christian ancestors, and they're living on borrowed time, and they'll squander it eventually because still they have no basis for their morality. So this is the objection. It relies on the idea that human beings, in order to be good, in order to behave well and to know what behaving well is, need commandments, need structures, need guidance, need dogmas in order to know. Because if they don't know, they will behave badly. Well, the first part of the response to this objection is to say that behind this objection is not only a very dim view of humanity, but a very false one. A.J. Ayer, who was a famous philosopher and one-time president of the BHA, put this rather well. He said, the underlying assumption is that only purely selfish behaviour is natural to man. This assumption is false, and the conclusion that is drawn from it is invalid. If experience shows that people act unselfishly as well as selfishly, we can only conclude that both types of behaviour are natural. If the capacity for evil is part of human nature, so too is the capacity for good. And I think this is an important part of that of the response. Really, lying behind this objection is the idea that human beings are fundamentally flawed. They are sinful, they are dirty, they are, you know, outside of grace. They are bestial animals, red in tooth and claw. And what they need, what we all need, in order to be good, is to be coerced, is to be constrained, is to be, you know, have the law laid down for us. Because it's only by, you know, being chained to the wall of these commandments that we won't rush out and do our raping and murdering sprees. Now, I don't believe, obviously, that this priest who was making this case to me on that train journey, if he suddenly lost his faith, would actually go out on a raping and killing spree, the likes of which the Catholic Church has never seen. But if you really push his view and what lies behind it, that's sort of what he believes. That's sort of the assumption that he is making behind what he's saying. And I think that's the first part, therefore, of the way to respond to this sort of objection to humanism, to say, actually, is that really right? Is that really what human beings is like? Is that what your mum's like? Is that what your gran's like? Is that what, you know, your child is like? You think this of these people? You think this of yourself? No. But the second thing to say is that, in any case, morality, this ultimate idea of morality, is not from God. It's not even from religion in the first place. This whole claim that, you know, mankind, humanity, was, you know, doing each other in, scrabbling around in the dirt, red in tooth and claw, until at one moment morality came to them, you know, beamed into them by whatever, on tablets of stone. That's just not how it happened. Charles Darwin makes the pithiest expression of this in The Descent of Man. The social instincts, the prime principle of man's moral constitution, with the aid of active intellectual powers and the effects of habit, naturally leads to the golden rule, as ye would that men should do to you, do ye to them likewise. And this lies at the foundation of morality. So morality originally isn't something that came from outside. It isn't something that came from a god in form of commandments. It isn't even something that came from one exceptional person who thought it up one day and said, right, this is really how we need to behave. It's something that is built into our humanity. Morality, what we call morality now, is an organized attempt that human beings are making. It's an organized attempt to reinforce the social instincts that we have, that our evolution has given us. That was the view of a famous humanist educationist called Margaret Knight. I think it's a good phrase, an organized attempt to reinforce the social instincts. And it comes from us. It's an artifact of our humanity. It arises out of our interactions with each other. It doesn't come from outside. And it doesn't depend on outside for its origin. And as well as not coming from outside originally in some sort of foundational sense, we don't need religion to sustain it. Margaret Knight, as I was mentioning her just earlier, humanist educationist from the mid-20th century. She has the honour of having been the most complained about BBC programme until the days of Jerry Springer, the opera, because of two talks she gave on the BBC Home Service, roughly what Radio 4 is now, I suppose, about morality without religion. When she dared to suggest that morality might be separable from religion and that moral education in schools might be separable from religious education in schools and appeared on the front covers of the next day's newspaper under the headline, The Satanic Mrs. Knight. I know. Oh, did someone say, ah? Oh, that was really kind of you. Poor Margaret Knight. Don't feel too sorry for her. She got to meet Bertrand Russell out of it, and she had a great life and a good book deal. So... But it is quite amusing to look back at her, because there it is, the satanic Mrs. Knight. And sitting underneath is this very typical-looking 1950s housewife with a perm and a little hat, sort of smiling at the camera like this. She doesn't look at all satanic. Well, that's how Satan gets you, actually, isn't it? Yeah, in the form of 50s housewives. That's a digression. She said, "Why should I consider others? Myself, I think the only possible answer to this question is the humanist one. Because we are naturally social beings, we live in communities, and life in any community from the family outwards is much happier and fuller and richer if the members are friendly and cooperative than if they're hostile and resentful." So we can have pragmatic, you know, prudential reasons to sustain morality, to pass it on, to be good, to celebrate the good things that human beings do. So that's morality. I've got time for one more, which is about meaningless. I'm going to ignore that slide. Meaningless at all. This is another good objection that comes up quite a lot. You people who are humanists, how awful, how pointless, how meaningless, how dry and arid and without form and purpose is your life. Humanism is nihilism. If there is no God, no future life, and the universe is a totally natural phenomenon, the universe has no purpose. That means our lives are meaningless. We might as well have never lived, because nothing means anything. I'm still young. I can do text speak. Is this text speak? No, it's not, is it? It's something else. Oh, I don't know. Anyway. Pointlessness. Bertrand Russell responded to this very well, in a sense, by pointing out that what lies behind this is a fear of death. It's a fear of death. This is the problem here. Religion, he said, religion, since it has its source in terror... He didn't pull his punches. Religion, since it has its source in terror, has dignified certain sorts of fear and made people think them not disgraceful. In this, it has done mankind a great disservice. All fear is bad. I believe that when I die, I shall rot, and nothing of my ego will survive. I am not young, and I love life. But I should scorn... to shiver with terror at the thought of annihilation. Many a man has borne himself proudly on the scaffold. Surely the same pride should teach us to think truly about our place in the world. And that's an important part of the response to this idea. Yes, okay, death is the end of our lives. Maybe that's a scary thing. Maybe that can be a frightening thing. But the response to that fact about reality, if you want to live your life in correspondence with the world as it is, and not the world as you would like it to be, is not to give in to some sort of better alternative that makes you feel better, but to be brave. to be braver than perhaps you feel like being, and to confront reality and to live a better life in accordance with the facts of reality as a result. Bertrand Russell, famous Welsh humanist, by the way, for 25 years president of the Cardiff Humanists. There's a fact that will serve you in good stead next time there's a Bertrand Russell pub quiz or something. Have we got anyone from Cardiff? Turning in his gravy, B. Bertrand Russell. No Cardiff representatives. Okay, so the first part of a response to this is don't give in to the fear. The second part of the response to this is to question the claim, really, that this life is meaningless as it is. There's the famous story Richard Dawkins tells about some atheist humanist being confronted with the question, surely you don't believe this is all there is, and coming back with the response, what do you mean, all? This is Matthew Arnold, one of the great 19th century agnostics, I suppose. Is it so small a thing to have enjoyed the sun, to have lived light in the spring, to have loved, to have thought, to have done, to have advanced true friends and beat down baffling foes, that we must feign a bliss of doubtful future date, and while we dream on this, lose all our present state, and relegate to worlds yet distant our repose? Absolutely vital part of the response to this objection, and that is to point out that if you think that true fulfillment, the true completeness of your life and of the lives of others will come after death in some other place, in some other life, not now but later, then you run the real serious risk of devaluing the life that you're living right now. And that's an insult not just to yourself but to other people too, the other people that you're sharing this life with, to say this isn't really it, this isn't the bit that's important, the bit that's important isn't here yet, this is just some preparation for that more important, better time. And that leads us, I think, to the final conclusion about this objection to humanism, which is to say that it's just got it completely wrong. In life, the meaning comes in living. It's not for later, it's not for tomorrow, it's for today. And that has nothing to do with the ultimate fate of the universe or the ultimate fate of humanity. You know, your lives are separate from that. It's vain, in fact, to try and link the two, to link your short destiny to the destiny of the whole of reality. I mean, how big-headed. In life, instead, the meaning comes in living. E.M. Forster, member of the BHA, humanist, novelist from the 20th century, the human race to which the individual belongs may not survive, but that should not deter him. Wherever our race comes from, wherever it is going to, whatever his own fissures and weaknesses, he himself is here, is now. He must understand, create, contact. Join the BHA. This is the obligatory plug. Very reasonable rates for students, support for all our campaigns and education work, and a warm glow of meaning and purpose to help you cope with the pointlessness of the universe. Thank you very much.
That's it. If you'd like to find out more about the Podilution and listen to the other speakers from the AHS convention or our regular weekly show, just head over to podilution.co.uk. Thanks for listening.